CIA, motherfucker.
Wise man say, forgiveness is divine, but never pay full price for late pizza. Cause you're a freak with a microphone.
I am an FBI agent.
You're listening to the Super Podcast, featuring hosts Super Marcy.
And I think everybody these days can relate to Serial Mom.
And Pete the Terrible Aussie.
But one of my pet peeves in movies, like people sitting down to have dinner and they don't actually finish the dinner.
This podcast contains coarse language.
See, watching this, like, I just want to go and...
Adult themes.
Like, the whole, this whole movie is just hinges on someone's ass.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Visit supermarcy.com for more information. Now for our feature presentation.
Listen, sister, if I want your opinion, I'll beat it out of you.
By the way, his testicle retrieval operation went quite well.
White Russian. No ice. Hold the vodka. Hold the Kahlua.
Isn't this 4215 pussy way?
Hey everyone, this is B. Jamine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome to episode 174 of the Super Podcast. And this is one of our special interview editions of the show. And what makes this one particularly special is that it is actually a joint production with my solo podcast, Bead versus the Living Dead. But yes, that is right, everyone. This is a Super Network / Bead versus the Living Dead Network special episode that is simultaneously going to be released on both the Super Podcast and Bead versus the Living Dead podcast feeds, which is very exciting. And also, you can listen to the Bead versus the Living Dead version of this episode on all podcast streamers everywhere right now. So you're probably wondering, why are both the Super Podcast and Bead versus the Living Dead teaming up for an episode of a podcast? Well, there's a pretty good reason for that. And there's two, as a matter of fact. The first one being is that the special guest that we're interviewing today is someone we have had on one of the other shows on the Super Network, the 2B Tuesdays podcast, and he is a good friend of ours as well. And the second reason why is that his latest directorial effort just happens to be a zombie film. For both those reasons, Marcy and I decided to join forces for with mine and her show and my solo show together to conduct this interview. For this episode, we are joined by Ryan Ebert, who has written films for the company The Asylum, such as Tales of the Fifth Grade, Robin Hood, and Shark Side of the Moon, which we both have done on episodes of the 2B Tuesdays podcast. And he's here to talk about his film, Resident Dead, which is a mockbuster of the upcoming horror film Resident Evil from Zach Cregers. So it's very exciting that Ryan wanted to sit down and talk about the film. Unfortunately, though, Super Marcy herself wasn't able to join this episode of the show due to health reasons. So Ryan and I did this interview solo. But regardless, though, Marcy was definitely there with us in spirit. And even though she wasn't able to make the interview herself, we kind of figured, you know what, let's still make this a co-production between the Super Podcast and Bead versus the Living Dead. So with that out of the way, here's the interview with Ryan Ebert.
I've been bit. It's over.
We're going to figure this out, babe.
I need access to a cure.
Deliver the case to New Haven.
Do this and you get your cure.
We have to work together.
Lead the way. You have something of mine. And we're going to find it.
And joining us today is a man who works for the production company The Asylum. He has written quite a number of films for them, particularly Shark Side of the Moon, Shark Warning, and many others. But as a director, he has also directed the films The Jolly Monkey, Predator Wastelands, Summerween, and he is back with his latest directorial effort, which is a mockbuster of the upcoming Zach Cregger's film Resident Evil. And he is someone who I know personally because he has appeared on episodes of the To Be Tuesdays podcast over on the Super Network. And that, of course, is writer-director Ryan Ebert. Hello, Ryan, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Bede. Good to be back. Or I guess here for the first time, but back with you.
Yes. Yes, unfortunately, my regular co-host, Super Marcy, wasn't able to be here today to talk about your latest film, Resident Dead. But she is definitely here with us in spirit. I know she would have loved to have been here to talk about this film with you. So, and I'm excited that you have a mockbuster of Resident Evil coming out. So I guess my first question for you, Ryan, where did the idea to wanting to do a mockbuster on the upcoming Resident Evil film come from?
Well, this one was actually, normally the process is the head of development will meet with one of the executives who makes the decisions on what movies we're going to be tying into. And they will say yes, 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 no, no, yes, yes, yes. And then those will kind of be those movies for the year. We also do disaster movies and shark movies that aren't tie-ins as well. But specifically for those, there's usually a meeting every few months to just kind of stay on the up and up. This one, however, was a bit of an anomaly in that normally we like to shoot our movies at least 4 to 6 months ahead of time so that post yep. can have enough time to really do their thing. But I think what happened was a movie that we were going to tie into around the same time, I forget which one, pushed like a year. So suddenly a movie that we were going to be working on no longer existed for us until next year. So it was a mad dash to kind of replace that movie because that was, it's going to be coming out at that time. This would have been end of May, I think. End of May, maybe middle May. We needed to find a replacement movie. And we haven't done a zombie movie in ages. Really since, I think, Z Nation was a big thing. Once that kind of died down, I think the company in general was a little zombied out. So there needed to be something. And the only thing that kind of made sense in that window that works for us was the Resident Evil movie. And so the head of development brought it up to the executive and he was like a very reluctant, okay, we'll get back in the zombie game a little bit. But yeah, the second that was open and available, I reached out and was like, yeah, let me have it. Because as long as I've been here working at or around the asylum, which is 2018, 2019 was when I wrote my first movie for the asylum, it had never come up for me to have the opportunity to do a zombie movie. I think we'd maybe done like Zombies 2, Aquarium of the Dead, like, but those might have been the very last things we did, and Z Nation might have still been on at that time. The details are a little, anything pre-pandemic is a little fuzzy about the timeline. But yeah, so that just, it was a rare opportunity, and I grabbed at it.
Well, did you always want to just, not because obviously writing the screenplay for you, because you are a prolific writer for The Asylum, was it at the beginning of developing this film, were you just originally tasked to just write the film, or did you have intentions to both write and direct this one?
I made it very clear very quickly to the people the executives who ultimately hire people as the director. Once I was brought on to write it, I was like, I would like to, let's just make this a super easy process for all involved. You hire me, I will write it and direct it. And thankfully, the last couple of movies that I had done have all turned out pretty solid for asylum movies, always that asterisk. But so they were pretty pleased to to just let that happen. And then I might be jumping ahead a little bit, but the script had to be written so quickly in order to, because we basically, I was told to write a one pager middle of May. We're shooting this thing in June. So from no movie to boots on the ground and action in maybe a month, including writing the script and coming up with the story. So it was all very, very as expedited as it's ever been done.
Well, knowing that this film, being that it is a mockbuster of Resident Evil, and having seen my fair share of Asylum movies throughout the years, particularly the ones you've written, how important was it to you as a filmmaker and also a storyteller to not only make a film that at least, well, I mean, obviously people are going to expect some type of Resident Evil elements in this film, but also kind of make it stand on its own as a zombie film, like trying to have a mixture of the two as well. So what was the process of writing the film so that way it could just be equally a mockbuster, but also having your voice in there as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. So obviously there are certain elements that we kind of look at. We look at the Resident Evil, what the storyline is. It's not so much just matching genre to genre, zombie movie to zombie movie. We try to do a little bit of a, base it loosely off of the general premise. So what I kind of latched onto when reading the synopsis, because there really wasn't a ton of information out on the details of the story at the time for the Resident Evil movie. So what I kind of latched onto was essentially this guy is taking a package from A to B, and then there are zombies in between. And that's what I based, because I sent the Asylum three pitches, and they all kind of had that as the core element. And the one that they ultimately picked was ironically my favorite. So I'm glad that kind of, I don't know, it just kind of shone through that much more that this is the one I kind of want to do, or if it just happened to be one that made sense for them. But that was kind of the core element. But then I also, you know, one of my big, not that it's zombies exactly, but one of my big favorite stories ever told is from The Last of Us. So I kind of wanted to have at least characters that are as grounded as those, with relationships that are as powerful and impactful as the ones in that story. And then just kind of taking things from other successful stories that I really like that are in a similar vein and just kind of meshing them together. And after the log line is picked, this is the one sentence, two sentence story. We then expand it to a one pager, which has teaser, act one, act two, act three, all the way through end of act eight, all in a page. And that's where I could really kind of flesh out like, okay, I want this element. I want these people to be the bad guys that are human, because there have to be bad humans in every zombie movie. And then using some other elements from Resident Evil proper, because it seems like this movie isn't quite there are elements, but there are some things that they're kind of not going to be touching on that other movies have. I have an evil pharmaceutical manufacturing company in Resident Dead, things like that are just that are doing genetic experiments and things, mutating zombies and whatnot. So taking certain elements that touch on what we're tying into, but yeah, spinning it into, it's a different kind of world. It's not quite as, it's a lot more grounded, I think, which resonates with me a little bit more. Not Resident Evil is perfect for what it is, but for me, what, especially on the budget that I'm working with, having people being in, having it as grounded as possible is something that's a little bit more attainable than something that you'd need more than 75 visual effects and you did 7-8 figure budgets to accomplish. We don't have them. So having it be a little bit more simple and then having key moments be bigger and more asylum crazy nonsense, that was definitely key. But I think we found something kind of that really worked on this one more so.
Yeah, well, I think
some of the other movies.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things I sort of noticed with a lot of the projects you work on with The Asylum, even if it is a mockbuster or if it has a premise that is very silly and over the top, you always find a way to still ground it with the characters and actually develop them so that at least as an audience, we can care about what's going on. And that's one of the things I found very interesting about Resident Dead is you with the characters, particularly the main characters of Joe and Ashley, who are a father and daughter duo, and something happens to Ashley at the very beginning of the film, which we won't go into spoilers for this episode, seeing that it is the movie is out, but of course Joe has to go on this mission to help her. But I really like the core dynamic between Joe and Ashley and their relationship with each other, because I have noticed in quite a lot of your work, you always have this sort of parent and child relationship in a lot of the work that you have done. And not to say that it's like necessarily like a trademark that you do, but I think you do quite well at establishing these type of effective relationships at the center of them. So when it came to the characters in this film, was it important to you so that even if, yes, the audience knows this is a mockbuster, you still want them to care about what's going on with the characters in the film?
It's huge for me. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you just need I think one thing that I learned in Predator Wastelands specifically was, and there were some situations that arose in the filming of that movie that were beyond anyone's control that kind of limited the action that we could do. Could have maybe explored those relationships in a different way and really had it a lot more action centric. But that being said, one of my biggest issues with a lot of Asylum movies for a stretch, in particular the disaster movies, is that these are just robots saying words and I don't care about them. So that's something that I've really wanted to, whenever I get the chance to sink my teeth into something, I want you, because the stakes are that much more magnified when you actually give a shit about who it's happening to. If you don't, then it's just a movie in the background. But if you do actually find yourself caring about these people, then you pay attention and you might hopefully like what you're watching. And then some of the budgetary constraints and the technological restraints that low budget filmmaking provides, you care about those things less, because at its core, if you're watching characters you care about in a situation that is stressful or whatever's supposed to be going on, it just hits you more and you pay attention more and you root for them or you hate that guy. And if you don't have these things, then it's just boring, and boring is about the worst thing you can be, especially when you're making a B movie. You might as well have a little fun with it.
And also too, I think what is I really enjoyed most about the film is you got quite a solid cast in all the roles in this film, and I think everyone does a good job. But I did particularly, again, like the relationship between the characters of Joe and Ashley, because the two actors that you cast in those roles, John Wells and Isabel Ramirez, are very good. And I really love their scenes together, because they definitely had a father and daughter bond between the two of them. So when it came to casting this film, like, did you have specific actors in mind? Like, you knew who would be perfect for these roles? Or was it like during the casting process, you discovered all these actors who were just perfect for these characters?
It was pure luck that any of this happened. The line producer, who Ben Galera, who line produced the movie, we shot it in Mississippi and he has kind of a base over there. So they had just shot a movie over there and one of the actors in that was a friend of his. And when it was like, hey, Ryan's going to be directing this one, Ben, who line produced Shark Side of the Moon. So I've known him for a minute. But he, in his like kind of introductory email to the whole Resident Dead team, was like, hey, and Ryan, there's this actor, John Wells, who I know he's just in this movie. And I think he'd be perfect for the character of Joe. And not that I'm casting it, but just take a look. And in my head, I'm just like, that's right, you're not casting it. This is my movie. I'm directing this one. I get to pick who's in the cast. Well, he's in the list of people who auditioned for the character, and shit, he was the best one by like 100 miles. He was the number one pick, not even close. And thankfully, I saw that. And thankfully, the executives who officially make the choice saw that as well. So that was begrudgingly against my will. We landed on John. And Isabel, who had, this is, I believe, her first feature. So she's pretty new to, she's done some short films and she's acted before. She's auditioned for a couple of movies that I directed, the Shark Frenzy and Summerween. I believe she auditioned for both of them, for sure Shark Frenzy. And didn't pick her in my top three then. I thought she was good, but just not. Basically, when you're casting, you get a list of 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 actors vying for the role, and then you pick your top three, and then those get sent to the execs, and they ultimately make the final choice. But I had four strong contenders for Ashley, and Isabel was in the third and fourth spot, and she was teetering into the fourth spot because I like, if I liked working with an actor before, that's kind of the tiebreaker for me. And one of the third actress that Isabel was kind of fighting against that she didn't know about, but she'd worked with me on Summerween. So they were both very strong, but it was on the cusp of not making it. But I brought my wife over and was like, hey, look at these two. Who would you pick to be in the third spot? And she looked at them both and she said, Isabel. And she was so confident about it. And I was like, okay, well, I trust you. And I'm so glad I listened to my wife because it's the first scene we shot. And I could talk about the rest of the cast all day. Everyone just was, we got so lucky at so many different steps with getting the right people at the right time. But the first scene I think that we shot was the scene where they're walking up to their house, their little shack in the woods for the first time after all the horribleness has happened. They're arriving at the house and she's struggling with the door. And that to me that's a big scene to shoot right away. It's an emotional scene for both of them. And they have to play it in kind of a, there's a lot of ways you could play it. And there's a way that I had it kind of in my head. And I yelled action and they just nailed it. They just like out the gate, it was just like exactly right. I had a couple of little nitpicky notes, not that you get maybe one or two takes on everything if you're lucky with an asylum movie because you got to shoot in 6 days. But that one, I just, we were going into some different coverage, so I had him tweak it a little bit, but like not, it was very, I'm so used to the first take is like a rough draft of the actors performing it. That maybe they've rehearsed it, maybe they haven't. Like you're lucky with just the time constraints. But they were just, it was as if we've been rehearsing it for years and they finally got the chance to do it. And it was just incredible. It was magical, truly. And that's when I knew, when I yelled cut for the first time, I was like just mentally in the back of my head, this might work, which is not something you think often when making an asylum movie. But those two were just, yeah, they had chemistry out the gate. John has a daughter about Isabel's age that looks, it's the spitting image. They're like the same. So he just immediately had that connection. And John's just such a, he's such a, it was a good combination of a seasoned veteran of acting in these fast-paced movies and such a nice, generous, caring, talented guy who was able to kind of take her under his wing. And Isabel, to her credit, for someone who's never been in a feature before, she you wouldn't have guessed it, she showed up to set ready to go, and she was just incredible and confident and just delivered a phenomenal performance in every single scene that she was in. But those two working together was just magic, because he had just the experience and confidence to give her the matching confidence that she was able to play into. And it just worked. And that's just so lucky, because I've only maybe had one or two actors that I've worked with in any of the movies I've ever written or directed that I would maybe try not to work with again. And none of them were like that awful, just maybe not super fun to work with. But these two were just special. It was just a special relationship to see, and then for it to be the correct kind of chemistry. And they were communicating constantly. He was like, hey, as my daughter, what are you comfortable with? Are you comfortable with me kissing me on the forehead or something, in like an emotional moment? And they worked that out together. And I'm not going to work around or against what everyone's comfortable with. So they kind of worked that out, and then I just let them go with that. But yeah, that was just two actors, one that I was begrudgingly accepting to even look at his tape, and another actress that I had almost left off the top three completely, were cast in this. And it's just incredible to watch what they did in the 6-day stretch that we had.
And it really does show throughout the film, particularly the moment you at the door that you mentioned before, which was definitely one of the more emotionally effective scenes for me watching it. And what about the rest of the cast? Like, again, everybody else is so solid in their roles. How did the casting the other supporting characters come about?
Oh my God. So these things, as noted, these things move very quickly. And that includes casting. So the character of Dawn, for example, we had cast somebody in that role, sent her an offer. This was 72 hours before we were started, before day one. We sent this actress an offer, and she declined. Not enough money. Fair. Respect it. She got back quickly and professionally. We sent an offer out to a second actress who accepted. Great. Then she got the script, and she was overwhelmed by how much she had, too many lines, too much to do, which in the amount of time that we were giving her, which is fair, but at the time very frustrating, because no one's going to have more time than you. And she took, after accepting, she wound up turning the role down about 12 hours, 18 hours later. So we had to cast the character of Dawn, who's one of the most important characters in the movie, basically overnight. We had to find somebody. They had to get there and get wardrobe approved and get makeup approved and every little detail. But we got this actress she was in Shark Frenzy, Miss McMillan, and because she had auditioned and she was on my if none of the top three are available, go to these three. So it was a strong audition, but I thought she was too young for the role, because there is kind of a weightiness to this character, that she's basically operating this smuggling ring or orchestrating runs throughout the entire area and making sure supplies are getting where they need to be. So I kind of envisioned it being somebody in their 30s, 40s. And I don't know how old McMillan is, but I don't believe she's 30s or 40s. And she just played in Shark Frenzy. She was a just going to college girl, party girl, who gets eaten by a shark. And she's perfectly great in that. But she got the call with like 24 hours until we were shooting. And she said yes. She flew in. She got makeup. When she landed, her nose was, when I arrived to her wardrobe fitting, her nose was in the script. And she was asking questions. And she was like, I just want to get this right. And da da da. And I don't think she ever messed up a line. I don't think she ever, like I said, I can always tell which actors are going to be my favorites and which ones are going to be okay and which ones are going to be maybe not my favorite. by how many questions they ask about the character. And the whole cast across the board constantly asking me questions, making sure they had the right idea for this or if they were wrong about this. And she was asking me questions left and right and trying to make sense of things that she didn't think made sense. And then I'd explain it. And then sometimes it still didn't make sense because this script went from 0 pages unwritten to pencils down, it's over in 2 weeks. So there were a couple of just logistical errors, nothing too crazy, but a couple of things that just didn't quite make sense. But thankfully, because I directed it, I got to make it make sense. And because I listened to my actors, when they would bring up problems, I would be like, oh yeah, that doesn't quite make sense. Let's have you say this instead of this. Okay, great. And then we're good. And thankfully, I had a cast that was asking a lot of questions, and we were able to fix any plot holes or storyline tweaks that we needed to make. But yeah, she was incredible. And the fact that she only had about 24 hours notice before she was in character, on set, full costume, in scenes where there's action and stuff is happening, is just a credit to her talent. And then the character of Wilt was another one that I was a little nervous about, because he's kind of he's a dick. He's kind of an asshole, but you kind of like him. And that's kind of a hard needle to thread sometimes. You do need an actor that can actually pull that off. And he also needs to pull off some pretty awesome action. And we landed on this guy, Hamid, who is this incredible stunt actor who's been in things like Black Panther, and he's done some other Marvel stuff as a stunt person. And I'm so grateful that he was another one that I was like, not 100% sure from the self-tape. He was one of my top three for sure, but I wasn't 100% sure. But then he got to set, gotten in wardrobe, and I was like, yep, we're in. This is going to be great. And again, he asked so many questions and wanted to make sure he got everything right. He FaceTimed me, and I don't FaceTime often, but he FaceTimed me and was like, hey, so just making sure this is right. This thought I had, does this work? And maybe I should kill this person in this scene. And be like, yeah, maybe you should. So just every actor in it was just so eager and excited. The actor who plays Sal, the villain, that was another case of we hired another actor. He said yes. Then maybe 36 hours before he was supposed to be on set, he said he couldn't make it. The dates didn't work for him. The dates didn't change. So I don't know what happened, if he just wasn't communicated with ahead of time or what. But so we had to mad dash scramble. Thankfully, this guy, Gerard Brock, he was my number one choice, that he was ultimately not picked by the executives, but they picked him. And thankfully he was able to come in on set. And the first stuff he's doing is the stuff towards the end of the movie. That was his day one with the height of all the action and everything that's happening. He's only just gotten the script and he's just got his lab coat on for the first time. And who am I talking to? Who's the other lead? Who am I? But he came in and again, peppered me with questions. He was as off book as anyone could be, considering the monologues that he was given out the gate. And he had some action to do, and he was like, I've done theater stunts before, I've done stage combat, like, I'm ready to go for anything you throw at me. And we threw some stuff at him, and he delivered. Yeah, I just the amount of things that could have gone wrong are astronomical. And the fact that so many things that were stressful at the time, actors dropping out at the last second, it all worked out because the cast we got was phenomenal. And everyone just fit their role so well. And again, just peppered me with questions to make sure they were all on the same page and everyone got there. And it feels like a much more cohesive, no one's not in the right movie. Sometimes you'll watch these and be like, this guy is in a sci-fi original and this person's in a Lifetime movie and this person is barely even present. And so it's like they're all kind of in different movies. This one feels like everyone's in the same movie for the most part. And that's a credit to everyone giving a shit and wanting to do a good job, and just a testament to who they are as people on top of who they are as actors. And all of them are clearly capable actors. So the fact that they all showed up being incredible people as well, who wanted to do a good job, that's not something that always happens. And I was very lucky to land all the people that I did.
And going into the film, because as you've mentioned a few times already, that it was shot over 6 days. How hectic was it just shooting an entire 90-minute film within that time frame? Because I know, both in my experience and also what I have read, sometimes a lot of productions will shoot maybe 1-2 pages a day, depending on what the scene is. But how many pages of the script were you shooting each of those 6 days?
Well, this one I could tell you with a lot more certainty, because a lot of times it's just chaos. Some days are the most I've ever shot was, I think, 35 pages in a day. On this one, we had to average 20 pages a day for the first 5 days, because the last day, the only location we shot at was we shot the teaser on the last day. So, and that was 4.5-5 pages. So I made it my mission to make sure that we got every single thing done in those first 5 days, so we wouldn't have to shoot the stuff on this bridge and then move to a different set to finish those things or find matching woods to try to get these scenes. I wanted everything to be done so we could spend as much time doing the bridge scene and all that action, and then the next piece of action, no spoilers. I wanted to make sure we had all the time in the world to shoot those things, because if we get those right, a successful teaser draws you in for the movie. You can very easily start watching a movie 2 minutes in and be like, oh, this isn't any good. And then you might even be able to return it and get a full refund, depending on what service you're using. I don't want that. I want you to stick around and watch the movie. So I really made it my mission to get those. And some days we got 15 pages done, and other, I think the last day 5 of 6 was a 30 page day, because we had some stuff we had from a previous day that we didn't get shot that we had to push to that day. But no overtime. And it's a 12-hour day for here, but no, and that's all built in. Everything, for those who don't know, a film shooting day is a 12-hour day in America. In Australia, it's a 10-hour day, but because you guys care about work-life balance and stuff.
Yeah.
But in a 12-hour day, we had no overtime, and we shot anywhere from 15 to 20 to 30 pages a day for the first 5 days. And then on day 6, which was the hottest day by a wide margin and like 90% humidity, that's when we got to do all the bridge stuff in the open air, just the sun just hitting us so hard. But the zombies are supposed to look dead, so they definitely, we went through a lot of water bottles that day, but a lot of sunscreen. But that was the struggle, was trying to make sure we at least kept pace of 20 pages a day through the first 5, so that the last day could be not necessarily easier, but at least more focused on the 4.5-5 pages we had to shoot.
And with the zombies themselves, when you were developing them in terms of like their look and also how they act within the story, did you go back and forth whether you wanted these zombies to either be the slow walking zombies or the fast running zombies? But with the film, you find at least a combination of the two, depending, I guess, how fresh the zombie is and also how long they've been dead for. And also there's a couple of surprises in there in terms of there may be or maybe not super zombies in this film, but there's people have to watch this zombies to find out.
I'll announce that here. Again, at this time, the movie is out, so you can go find it out for yourself. But generally speaking, yeah, I think logically, if zombies were to be a thing, the freshly turned ones would be as fast as they get, And then as muscle mass decays, they become slower and withered and not as necessarily as menacing. But yeah, it was definitely a mix. Some of it's just what's appro like if I'm not going to ask, we had some zombie actors that were stunt people, and we asked those zombie actors to do some crazy things. We had a guy jump off a fire truck and land on a guy. And that was the beauty of having Hamid on set, is that he's a stunt guy, so he could take the he knew how to have somebody fall on him from a story up and land with both of them landing safely. And the guy who jumped on him was his friend, who was another stunt person that we had on set. So those people we asked a lot out of. And then sometimes we had some older in their 50s and 60s and people that are just like, I just want to be in a zombie movie. Well, we're just going to have you kind of stand up and put your arms out and go rawr. And that I feel obviously different strains of a zombie virus can maybe do different things, but I don't feel like in general the body would be able to do things that it wasn't previously capable of doing. So if you're as if you in real life can do a backflip and run a marathon and do these incredible athletic feats, you as a zombie initially can probably do many of those things mindlessly. But if you're 100 years old, you're probably not leaping out and running 20 miles an hour, and you just don't have the physical nature for that. And again, different zombie things do things differently. If I were making the zombie movie of my dreams, yeah, the old lady could leap out of her wheelchair and bite you in the jugular, and that would be amazing. But when you're dealing with, oh, you have five extras today who are zombies, and two of them are in their 50s and one of them has a bad back, all of them game and excited to be there. So, and I was happy to have anybody who could be there. But you work with what you're working with. And I'm not going to ask anybody to do anything beyond what they're physically capable of doing. So that's how we landed on the zombie physicality overall. But we definitely had some zombies written in there that were faster, bigger, stronger. And for those particular zombies, stunt people were involved, and that was all budgeted accordingly.
And also, too, I think what I find interesting about the film Resident Dead is you got, obviously, from the sounds of it, this was a film that was not planned initially. It was one that was thought up at the very last minute. And now, and knowing that, being that this is a mockbuster for a major Hollywood film that's coming out, at least at the time of when this interview drops, is a few weeks away. I can imagine how hectic it would be to not only write, shoot, and do post-production on this film, but try to get it out before the film that you're mocking, quote unquote, is released. How, I mean, I guess for a lot of listeners who know of the Asylum and know that a lot of the productions always come out either around the same time or just before any of the major films that they're being a mockbuster of. Like, how hectic was it just to get all this film done and try to release it before the Resident Evil film?
It was, I would say, the setup was the most hectic thing. And just like in pre-production, getting everything organized quickly because they had just wrapped a movie in Mississippi just a little bit before we needed to start. So the line producer had to kind of wrap up his contracts there while also getting new locations looked at for things. So that was pretty hectic. And then obviously during it's a scrambled making the movie because we have all these actors dropping out, and we have thankfully there wasn't a lot in the way of crew issues. Everyone was kind of did just work on the previous movie that kind of knew the drill about what it's like, the speed that Asylum movies get made. They all had at least a little bit more experience than they had a few weeks prior, so that was very helpful. And everyone was across the board pretty strong at what they did. But then when it comes to, we had a little bit of some weirdness in post. Normally, the process is assembly cut that I look at, and then I try to make sense of it and give all of the notes in the world to try to make it into the movie that I actually want it to be. Then that cut goes to an executive who then gives his notes. And then that cut goes to another person, and then that person gives notes, and then that goes to the last person, the head of the company, and they give their notes, and when those are done, the movie's basically locked. And then the VFX artists can start pulling plates and start doing what they're doing, and color correction can really start, and all these things. But the middle person, so there's me, there's another guy, then there's that other guy. They were in Canada in the middle of the woods during the exact time that they needed to be watching the movie. So that kind of made it a little odd in the process and figuring, do we just skip to the last guy? Do we have somebody else look at it? Da-da-da. Ultimately, it was decided it would just go to the last guy, but that took a series of conversations to get there. And then he watched it and gave a bunch of notes, and then that got turned into, and then we had to also, there were some other weird stipulations we had to hit because somebody in sales had promised something about the movie to be to this other company, and that was a whole thing because it's always a little weirder than it has to be. But thankfully that all got figured out and movie got locked. And then it's just kind of the process of figuring out how these, most of the visual effects in the movie are blood, gunshots, things like that. But there's obviously some visual effects zombies in the movie that we had to figure out, what do they look like? How does that all work? And thankfully I was getting ahead of it with the head of VFX. So I kind of sent him a bunch of concepts of what I think these guys should look like. And he was able to use an artist to kind of mock a couple of things up. But you can only be as proactive as you can, because ultimately the people up top, they're the ones that make the decisions. So they have to actually find the time to approve these things. And we're making 30 movies a year. So it's just always super busy all the time. And finally, a couple weeks after it probably should have been, some things start getting approved and then visual effects can get worked on. But that's the hardest part, I think, is getting anything. Like, when it's original, like fully VFX characters that have to have a certain look, that's always difficult, getting on the same page. Or if it's creatures, if we do a mecha ape movie, trying to figure out how the mecha ape looks, you know, anything that's like that. That's a process. And that's trying to make sure that the filmmaker and the, because ultimately the executive's decision, they approve, this is the look, this is what it is. But you hope to at least get it into a place where they're not immediately, no, square one, what is this? And thankfully, there wasn't really a ton of that. They kind of liked the design that, based off of the examples that I gave. So it was just a couple of little tweaks, but it just took a while to actually get them to get their eyeballs on it because they're so busy. But so that kind of put VFX in a little bit more of a bind than we would have liked. But overall, that was maybe the most chaotic part, is just getting the VFX all done, because bless them, the VFX department here is just tremendously, they're asked to do a lot in not enough time. And I'm very happy with how, and it took pulling teeth a little bit, because I come from the world of screenwriting where I get 20 pages of notes on every script that completely changes the script, and I just have to grin and bear it. And I'm only paid a flat rate to write them. I'm not paid weekly like VFX artists. But heaven forbid I, as the director, give a single note to a VFX artist. Sometimes they lose their mind. Some of them are great, but some of them just get very offended at the fact that their rough draft wasn't perfect. But they get to work on 10 shots, but I have to, this movie's got my name all over it. So I'm trying to make sure that it is as best an example of what I was hoping to make this movie as it can be in the limited time we have to make it. And there was definitely some complaining, some people who were not thrilled with the amount of notes that I gave, which wasn't really that many, but I only get to make this movie once. And this one was particularly special and wanted to make sure that things were as good as they can be considering the constraints that we have. And I'm ultimately very happy with where we landed on that. But yeah, that was, if we had even 3 weeks to do the visual effects, 4 weeks would be just such an incredible boon. But they had like 10 days, I think, before we were screening the movie, and they got almost every shot done in those, it's like 7 or 8 artists got, they each get like 10 shots, and they got it across the finish line before the kind of final screening that we're doing, that we did, and where we give kind of our last round of notes on everything, first time we hear it with score and with color and all that. So credit to them for putting up with my nonsense, but they did a great job. And but that's the hardest part, is the mad dash to get all the visual effects done before it's too late. We're still, I'm done giving notes on all of that, but they're still getting a couple of notes as we speak to tweak and fix some things from the executives. It would have been more if I didn't give the notes early. That's all I'm
gonna say. Well, knowing that this is your 5th film that you directed and the 3rd of 2 others you directed this year with Summerween and Shark Frenzy, my question to you, having directed 5 films already, obviously with each film, you learn something as a filmmaker. With Resident Dead, what was the one thing that you learned about directing on this one that you would take forward for future productions?
That's such a great question. To me, it was just a great, I was as prepared for this movie as I could have been. A lot of it was because I had just written the script, so it was all very fresh in my head as we were shooting. But it really showed that the more, because problems just happen, problems just occur, that when you're shooting 1 or 2 pages a day, if you hit a speed bump, you're only going 5 miles an hour. You barely feel it. But shooting an asylum movie, you hit a speed bump, you're going 100 miles an hour, you could crash the car. And the more prepared you are for any kind of potential situation, and the more kind of head on a swivel you are seeing potential problems, this was maybe the first movie also where I really felt like, and a little bit less of a kind of glorified supervisor. And I got to work with Miles Channing again on all 3 of the movies I shot this year. Miles is just the best DP I could ask for. I gave him some homework to do. I was like, I need you to look at this book, and I need you to look at this show, and I need you to look at this thing. And that's visually what I'm going for. And he was like, okay. And then every time he'd line up a shot and I'd go to Video Village to check it out, it was exactly what I was hoping to see. And just a very good kind of back and forth. But being on the same page as him early, so that, because basically the less I have to communicate with the DP, the more time I can spend with the actors making sure they're on the same page. So it's trying to find a good balance of both, but I have at least a little bit more opportunity to speak to my DP ahead of time and get ahead of things. So that's something that I've really found is valuable. And then just going back to what I was starting to say earlier, there was like, we weren't planning on shooting part of this at a fire station. but that was a location that was available to us, and it looked really cool, and it fit kind of the vibe. So I said, sure, let's shoot it there. It was written to be something completely different, but just mentally, just being able to rework it in my head where, okay, instead of doing this and doing that over there, they're doing it at this location, and then they're bringing them inside the fire station, and that's where this action happens. Being able to be malleable like that on the fly is huge, and you can only do that if you're super prepared and know what you're supposed to actually be doing. But because we had this fire truck, obviously, one thing I'm not thinking is we're going to have somebody jump off of a fire truck. That's not in the script, but you pivot to that when the opportunity arises. But as we're setting up some stuff and the fire truck was parked outside of the station, I saw in the front of the truck says, "In God we trust." And as a more panicked and unprepared director, I might not have even noticed that. I'm just trying to make sure we make our day and we just get all the coverage we need. But because everything was a little bit slower for, like, it's like professional athletes, I'm looking at 100-mile-an-hour fastball. That thing looks like it's going 1,000 miles an hour. They look at 100-mile-an-hour fastball and it's like going 50 because they just, that's what they're used to. I was able to see, okay, let's have a zombie fight over here. Let's pivot this, and I want to make sure that this last piece of action ends with our hero plunging this axe into the zombie, standing heroically with "In God We Trust" on either side of him. And we were able to get that shot. And that's only because I was prepared and everything was moving more slowly around me. So that's kind of you got to keep your head on a swivel. The more prepared you are, the more malleable and adjustable you are to make these decisions quickly, because every decision you make when you're making a movie in 6 days is so impactful. Because if you go down the wrong path, you could be going down a cliff and then you're just kind of screwed. But this one, thankfully, because I knew the script very well and I felt so strongly about the story, I kind of felt like I knew where things needed to pivot to. There's another beat that in the script, it was written, writer me wrote Joe's character to be like furiously pacing, and he's so mad and he's punching the wall and he's trying to burst through the door. And in the moment, after they had acted the previous scene, I'm like, that doesn't work. That doesn't make any sense here. You need to be just catatonic. The energy just needs to come all the way down. Because if that's what it is, if you are just blowing things up right now and beating everything up and throwing things around, having a hissy fit, then the next thing we go into is also intense. And then the next thing we go into is also intense. And the next thing we go into is also intense. I've always said, what's more interesting? What's more fun? A roller coaster or falling down a bottomless pit? Roller coasters are way more fun. You got ups and downs and loop to loops, and I get motion sickness, so I wouldn't enjoy either of these things. But a bottomless pit, after a while, would get boring. It's just the same. It's just, okay, you're just careening forever. Like, you're going terminal velocity, but who cares at a certain point? So I made the choice to have him, instead of, as the script said, jamming into the door and fuming and drooling and da, 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 have him just catatonic and calm, almost no energy. And nobody in the notes process brought it up as being like, oh, I wish he was like fuming and da, 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 da. Everyone just thought it worked. It was great. And the actor felt like he was right at home with it. And I ran it by him. I was like, I feel like you would be pretty catatonic right now. And he was like, I agree. And no one knows your characters better than the actors who have to play them. Because that's another thing that you learn very quickly, is when you write these things, you're looking broad picture. You're looking at every single moment of every single character, every single scene, da, 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 da. But sometimes you lose the granular detail of each specific character and exactly what, I'd say it like this, or I'd say this like this, or I wouldn't do this. But the actor who has to solely focus on the character, they at least have certain insights that are so valuable and important. And that's another thing that I learned, not necessarily on this one, but it really, I got to, because everything slowed down a little bit, on this one was able to listen and adjust. And sometimes you have to tell the actor that was a direct note from the executives. They want it exactly like this. There's nothing I can do. You're right. I hear you, but they're paying the bills. They're paying it for us to be here to do exactly that thing. But more often than not, if what they say makes sense and it doesn't, if you know the script and you know the story, if it makes sense, follow that. Because good actors, which I was very lucky to have on this one, they have great instincts. And they can tell you where you messed up. And they can also find, they can find beauty in that. They can find, oh yeah, no, that it's kind of dumb, but I can make it work. But they can also tell you where you've made a mistake. And I brought this up earlier, but they can get you to fix it. And as again, very lucky to be able to, everything was slowed down enough on this one where I could listen and pivot and adjust as needed to make a movie that made sense instead of just scenes that were independent of each other that get cut together and there's a movie at the end of it. It felt like there was a little bit more flow to this one because everyone, I was able to listen to everybody and adjust accordingly.
And now with Resident Dead out of the way, what have you got coming up in the future? Because obviously you've got plenty more projects that you're working on, and one of them in particular may be coming down in my neck of the woods as well. So is there anything that you can divulge for our audience?
Well, I am sadly not going to be as in your neck of the woods as I would like to be, hoping to get you and Marcy a cameo. Mm-hmm. But I am going to Australia to direct a feature that I've been writing for Tubi for almost 2 years. It's finally been locked, and they were very lucky that they... I was offered the opportunity to write this script in the middle of directing The Jolly Monkey. So I wasn't really even a director at that point. I was starting to direct, Jolly Monkey being the first movie I directed. But obviously since then I've directed 5 movies, and that's how long it took to get this one approved, which has more to say about, I will say, the nothing disparaging, just the notes process took a little bit longer because there was some turnover in Tubi. So it was just kind of things kept getting shuffled around, and finally things got ironed out. But I will be coming to Australia to direct a shark movie that is super fun. And I'm thrilled to be able to do it in Brisbane/the Gold Coast area. We're looking at some beautiful locations over there. They're actively shooting the movie that my wife wrote right now as we're speaking. And that's shaping up to be, they're two tonally very different shark movies, but they are both super fun. And I'm thrilled to be able to direct the one that I wrote. I won't divulge any more specific information, but I am very excited about this one and looking forward to talking with you guys about this soon.
Well, I look forward to it as well. We'll find a way to get a cameo in the movie somehow, even if I have to green screen myself into the movie from Melbourne to the Gold Coast, or just put me on a bulletin board somewhere just with my face.
There you go. I'll find a way.
Yeah, I mean, just have us be eaten by a shark like this person on a newspaper clipping. There we go.
Problem solved.
But definitely, I would say come down to, if you ever do other productions in Australia, definitely come down to Melbourne. We have great filmmaking facilities down here too. And
I think there is a very real chance we are going to be doing more movies in Australia. So everything's been going so well. The Australian crews are great. Everybody that has been working on the first movie, I'm just going through auditions now on my movie. The actors are phenomenal across the board. So, and one of our executives is looking into even so far as buying real estate in Australia. So there's a very real chance. I don't know where specifically, but there's a very real chance we'll be making some movies, hopefully closer and closer to where you and Marcy are.
And I have to say, I mean, I don't want to pitch anything to you, Ryan, but I have to sort of say this. If you do make more movies in Australia, You got to do the Australian cliches of making films about giant spiders and giant kangaroos and koalas, where every animal spiders. In Australia wants to kill people.
Spiders is an absolute no-brainer. Any advice for me coming in to Australia? What's one key piece of advice you would give me before I step foot in your fine country?
Ooh, that is a great question. Ooh. Well, obviously, not every animal in Australia wants to kill you. Like, we always joke about here, like, oh, we have giant spiders and giant snakes and stuff like that. But it's really the very small ones you have to be wary of, the little tiny ones. So I would say be careful and also make sure to check your toilet, whatever. You're in there, because we have these spiders in Australia called redback spiders, and they have a habit of like hiding out in places like that. So always be careful.
That is one place I do not want to be that vulnerable. So I will definitely be protecting going forward. I mean, thank you for that.
And there have been occasions of like people waking up and then there's like a snake in their bed and stuff like that. Again, make sure to close your windows at night. Yep.
I don't think that wasn't much of a concern, but we'll make sure that happens. Yes.
Well, thank you, Ryan, for coming on the show today to talk about Resident Dead. And before we wrap up the interview today, where can people find you on the internet this week if people want to check out what you're doing on social media, but also where people can check out your previous work, where it's like streaming or you could buy or rent it? And also, where can people watch Resident Dead if they're interested in checking it out?
Fantastic questions. If you want to follow me, where you can probably get all of this information as I post about it, I am on Twitter and Instagram at the Ryan Ebert. Pretty simple. And most of my work, you can find a lot of stuff I've written on Tubi. Jolly Monkeys on there and Predator Wasteland are both available on Tubi. The rest of the movies are a little too recent to be there, but Summerween, Shark Thrash, and every other Shark Frenzy and all the other movies that I've written, most of them are available on Amazon Prime. They're available on Apple TV. They're available on Fandango and so many other, basically anywhere you can get things, rent or buy things video on demand. And Resident Dead will be out September 4th, at least here in the United States. And that will be available for rent or purchase at all those aforementioned places. And will probably be on Tubi in 6 months or so after that. Until then, rent or purchase, Amazon Prime, Apple TV, Apple Plus, and Fandango and iTunes and wherever else you find your videos on demand.
Well, thanks for that, Brian, and thank you for joining the show today.
Thank you for having me. This is always a treat talking with you guys.
Well, there you go, everyone. That was my interview with Ryan Ebert, the writer and director of Resident Dead. And thank you so much again for Ryan for sitting down to chat about the film on both the Super Podcast and Bede versus the Living Dead. Even though Marcy herself wasn't able to make this episode, I know that she is deeply appreciative of you sitting down to talking about the film for both our show, the Super Podcast, and my solo show, Bede versus the Living Dead. It really means the world a lot to the both of us. Now, Resident Dead is now available on streaming platforms to rent or buy. So if it is available in your country, definitely seek it out, especially if you enjoy a good asylum mockbuster and want something as a taste for Zach Cregger's upcoming Resident Evil film. So definitely seek it out if it is playing in your country. So yep, that is a wrap for both the Super Podcast and Bede versus the Living Dead. And I hope the listeners of both shows enjoyed this interview. Now, when it comes to finding all things the Super Podcast and Bede versus the Living Dead on the internet this week, you can follow all updates of the Super Podcast on the website supermarcy.com and on the Super Network on all podcast streamers everywhere. The Super Network is the home of many shows that Marcy and I host together, like the Super Podcast, obviously, but also the To Be Tuesdays podcast, the King Zone podcast, the Ozbloid cast, and Podcasters of Horror. Some of those shows are currently on a little bit of a hiatus, but don't worry, they will be back very soon. So stay tuned for updates of when those shows will return. And in terms of finding the Super Network on social media, you can follow all updates on everything the Super Network on Twitter and Blue Sky under SM the Super Network, Facebook under the Super Network, and you can find all of our shows and our many different reviews and articles over on supermarcy.com. And in terms of everything Bede versus the Living Dead, you can follow all updates of that show on Twitter and Blue Sky under Bede vs TLD, Facebook under Bede versus the Living Dead. And for me personally, you can follow me on Twitter and Blue Sky under Bejamine, Letterboxd under Bejamine, and of course, find all my work over on supermarcy.com. So, yep, that is a wrap for this very special combined episode of the Super Podcast and Bede versus the Living Dead. Marcy and I hope you, all our audiences of both these shows, enjoyed this one, and we'll see you all next time. See you, everybody. Bye.
Save the case and kill the fiend.
Why in the unholy hell is that?